I'm Shar Banerjee, and this is Books That Built Me. I'm an ex-executive turned to leadership coach specializing in people managers. My job is to get people out of that manager headspace and into their leadership growth space. I typically work with clients to build leadership DNA and self-leadership muscles in group programs or one-to-one coaching. But on this show, we dive deep into the stories of other leaders. And it all starts with a book that they believe has really influenced their decisions. And the lessons from this book are now lessons in their life. Welcome to Books That Built Me. Today, we're going to be discussing Man's Search for Meaning, which is a poignant memoir and psychological exploration written by Viktor E. Frankl, a Holocaust survivor and renowned psychiatrist. This story is about a journey through hell and back. Frankl takes us into the horrors endured in Nazi concentration camps. It's a haunting reminder of humanity's capacity for cruelty, but also the incredible resilience of the human spirit. He does not hold back when he describes the brutal reality of life in those camps, the hunger, exhaustion, humiliation, the constant fear of death looming over every moment. He paints a vivid picture of the dehumanization, the stripping away of dignity, the loss of everything familiar and comforting. But amidst all that darkness, he finds a glimmer of hope, a spark of humanity that refuses to be extinguished. What's truly remarkable is not only how he survived those horrors, but how he managed to find meaning in the midst of such despair. Despite being published over 7 decades ago, Man's Search of Meaning remains a bestseller with over 16 million copies sold worldwide. It was originally published in German, and this book was written only in 9 days. And interestingly, Frankl wanted to seriously remain anonymous. This book was inspired by the positive response that he received after he delivered a lecture in Vienna in 1946, shortly after his release from the concentration camps. Frankl passed away in 1997, but his legacy lives on through this book. Let's dive into this episode and get into conversation. All right, so this is the book that we're talking about today, Viktor E. Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And today we're joined in studio with Eric Nerlich, an executive coach who helps leaders find their meaning and grow their impact. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks, Shar. I'm excited to be here and to talk about this book. Mine looks a little different, but similar
idea. Oh, does it? Let's see it.
This is what my version looks like.
It's probably
20 years old is my version.
Yeah, you've got like a little candle flame, and I feel like I have sunrise, like the colors of sunrise or sunset. That's interesting.
Well, it's been around a long time, and I think my copy's probably 20 something years old. So,
I got the latest 2024 version. So that's that's also very interesting to know. So let's talk about that. Your copy is 20 plus years old. And the question that I really am curious about is, do you recall what initially drew you to this book and what, you know, like what was the story there?
Yeah, I don't actually recall what initially drew me to the book. Somebody recommended it to me and I picked it up. But what has stuck with me from the book is this idea of meaning, mm-hmm. and how the sense we make of our lives, the meaning we make of our lives, is something we have control over. Like the conditions can be what the conditions are, no matter how hard they are. And as you mentioned in your intro, the conditions were very, 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 very hard in this concentration camp where most people did not survive. And yet, even in that awful situation, people had a choice as to how they would face the conditions, but the meaning they would make of their suffering, of their existence. And there's a Nietzsche quote, which I'm going to get a little wrong, but it's something like, he who has a why to live for can bear almost any how.
You got to bang on, by the way. You got to bang on.
He uses that throughout the book.
Yeah.
And it's just so meaningful. It's like, once you know your why, everything else falls into place. But most people don't have clarity about why they're living. What mm-hmm. is the point? Mm-hmm. And if you can get to that, then my experience for myself has been, it just makes everything else fall into place a little easier. Because it's like, okay, now I know why I'm living. Mm-hmm. Then all the other decisions kind of roll up into that. Like they roll out of the why. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think he says something, and I think that's kind of what I took away from this book.
You know, there's this part that's really pulling me, which is the part where he talks about, you know, the meaning of life. When you say that, it feels so big and it feels so severe in nature. Like, this is the meaning of my existence. And, you know, he says, what matters more is not the meaning of your life in general, but rather the specific meaning of a person's life at a given moment. Hmm. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's, I think it's, there's so many things I make of it. I mean, one thing I've been trying to do for myself is learn to live more in the present, like let go of meaning, things I did in the past, let go of identities in the past that no longer serve me, and make meaning in the present, in the specific moment. Mm. And it's really counterintuitive, actually, especially in our, for people that grew up in, you know, American culture as I did. It's,
yeah,
we get very focused on like, okay, what's next? What's next? It's like a future orientation. The meaning comes from what's going to happen at some undetermined future time.
Right.
And there's value to that. Like, that future orientation served me very well. Like, get good grades, get into college, get grades in college, get a job, do well in the job to get the promotion, and the next job, and the next job, and the next job. But the challenge with it is it's always a chase. There's never any meaning in like what's here right now. And that's something that I struggled with pretty extensively about a decade ago, where I eventually burned out trying to chase the next what's next and had to really confront for myself, like, okay, why am I doing this? Why do I want that promotion? What's going to be different for me? And I had to update, you know, to that, back to your original point, the specific why of what I was looking for in this moment. And I had the programming in me, the cultural programming and the personal programming to like, go for what's next, go for the next obstacle, go for the next achievement.
Yeah.
I was like, but why? Why do I need that achievement?
Yeah.
And and a lot's unfolded for me since then as a result.
Yeah. You know, for anyone who's listening to this conversation between you and I and hasn't yet read the book, there is a series of steps actually that he generates as he talks about, like, what does it actually mean to create meaning in your life? And so the three that he breaks down into is like, and this is the one that you were talking about, right, Eric, the active life. So he says there's an active life, there's a passive life, and then there's something else. So an active life, you know, serves the purpose of giving people the opportunity to realize values, to create, to do creative work. And there's almost this like the doing element of life.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a passive life, which is more enjoyment, where you obtain fulfillment in experiencing nature and beauty, art, that sort of thing. Like, there's that inner being. That's at least the words that came to me when I was reading this. There's like the doing and then the being.
Mm-hmm.
And so he then introduces that there is also purpose in life that is almost barren of creation and barren of enjoyment. And this is, you know, this is the dimension that he really explored within in the concentration camp. And he underscores it to say, like, it's man's attitude to his existence, like finding a reason and then really underscoring that reason with an attitude, a decision, a choice on what that means to you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so powerful. And this choice of how do we interpret the events that are happening to us is so critical. It's, you know, 'cause stuff happens.
Yeah.
And you know, most of what happens to us is not as dire as a concentration camp, but stuff still happens.
Right.
And the meaning we make of it completely changes how we react. You know, so let's take a personal example for me. My 5-year-old disobeys me and says, no, I'm not going to do whatever. One meaning I could make of it is like, he's not respecting me and I'm going to show him who's boss.
Right.
Or I could say he's 5 and he just doesn't want to do it. And it's not about me at all. But let me tell you, my reaction in those two situations is very different. And let me tell you, I'm working on it right now to shift from the first one to the second one. But I mean, that's kind of a more lighthearted version. But like this choice of how to interpret the events that are happening to us is so critical to how we react in every single interaction we have. Yeah. And what I loved about Frankl's book is because of the completely extreme conditions he suffered under, he could get to the heart of this. Like, okay, I have no choice about where I sleep, what I eat, what I wear, anything, how I spend my time. And I still have freedom because I choose where to think. I choose what to focus on. I can, instead of focusing on the misery of my existence, I can think back on a simple pleasure I once had, a tender moment with my wife, or the thrill of completing my first manuscript. That's my choice. And they can't take that away from me, no matter what else they control. And I was like, whoa, that is powerful.
I mean, the man even would find scraps of paper to recall his manuscript that was taken away from him, to make notes. Because within him, there was this flame, this fire of like, that it was taken away is just part of the story. That it will be recreated again is the dream. And even to go back in past, I just also love the conversations that he would have with his wife. As if she was right there.
Yeah. It was very touching. And
very, yeah.
You know, it gave him something to struggle for, something, some reason to live. It would have been very easy to say, easy for him to say, I've got nothing to live for. I may as well just die. But he had the burning flame of his manuscript and he had the love for his wife. It's like, this is what I'm looking for. The chance to publish my book and the chance to reunite with my wife. And it's not, you know, like there was no guarantees, but he's like, I want to I want to live for that chance.
Yeah. And even apart from the book and the wife, which I feel are very compelling reasons to live, he would also find meaning in the memory of simple things like opening his front door and turning on the light switch in his apartment, to the point that it would bring him to tears, those memories of those simple moments in life that you just take for granted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it reminds me actually of like the Buddhists who meditate, and the Buddhist monk that sits in the forest and meditates for hours and appreciates all the nature and all the little things around him at all times. And it can bring them to tears because the wonder of nature is so powerful.
Yeah.
And something I have, I guess, started to learn is like all these books, all these traditions, all of them are connected because it turns out that it's all interpreting how we make sense of, how humans make sense of the world with the brains that we have. And so whether it's Buddhism or Christian mysticism or this book, like they all come back to some very similar principles and very similar experiences, which makes me think there's something deeper here.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's dive into the topic of suffering, because suffering is this theme that's ever present in the book. And, you know, Frankl discusses the idea of suffering, the concept of suffering, but really as a pathway to growth and transformation. And, you know, he suggests that adversity can ultimately lead to a deeper understanding of your own self, your own purpose. How do you interpret this concept in light of, you know, your own experiences with hardship and adversity?
Yeah. So he has a great quote, which I'm going to just read here. It says, suffering ceases to be suffering at the moment it finds a meaning. And I think that's really powerful. Again, it's how do we make sense of the experience that we're having?
Yes.
So like, again, I'm a parent with two young kids. If you subjected me to the experiences I've had over the past several years, it would be considered torture. Being woken up several times a night, screaming children, like it's like, you know, like uninterrupted sleep, unreasonable demands, like loud noises at unexpected times, randomly getting hit and pooped on and puked on, like, you know, this would be considered torture by pretty much anybody. If you did it into a prisoner, they'd be like, no, this is against the Geneva Convention. And yet people every year put up with it. Why? because they have a meaning in it. They're like, oh, right. being a parent is more meaningful. So therefore it's not suffering. It's just parenting. It's like,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of so interesting. Like objectively, it's a horrible experience. And yet millions, billions of people sign up to do it every year.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so parenting is a great example. And what's also coming to mind is, you know, I come from the world of sales. And in sales, rejection is the constant narrative. To get nine no's is a good thing because the tenth response is going to be a yes. That's the, you know, that's the training. Like, get a smile on your face because the yes is coming. And so in my sales training days and, you know, in that life and universe, I can also see how this is so relevant. The choice for you to say that, you know, this is no longer suffering because there is a meaning to it. Like, this is just the job, or this is just the nature of the work that I do. Or if you're an entrepreneur and you've got to get that hard, thick skin of like, oh man, why didn't that strategy work? Or why isn't this, you know, one thing that I had hoped for panning out? What happens if you say, well, that's just the nature of it all. Like, that's just how it goes. Like, it's actually not suffering. It's part of parenting. Like, to your point, like, it's part of being a parent.
And, you know, and it gives meaning to the suffering. It's like the entrepreneur, it's like, I have this great vision of this people I want to help and the product I want to bring to the world to help them. Like, yeah, it's worth putting in these 100-hour weeks so that I can get to that outcome. And like, this happens all the time. And, you know, you mentioned I work as an executive coach working with leaders, and this is a lot of what we get to. It's like, there's a Simon Sinek book and TED Talk, Start with Why. Same idea.
Yeah.
Why are we doing this?
Yeah.
If you can articulate that for yourself and for your team, everybody gets on board. They're like, oh, right.
Yeah.
We are all unified. We're all aligned towards moving towards this thing. Let's get there. Let's do it. We've got this.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's why I find this book so powerful. It's like, it's relevant in like everyday interactions. Even though it describes this completely almost unimaginable horrors that are so far from our daily experience, the lessons apply. And that's what I love about it.
Mm. You know, and even with the Simon Sinek thing, you know, he talks about it's the concentric circles, right? The inner circles, the why, then the outer two circles are the what and the how.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, like, at no point does he talk about what and how. At no point is he saying that the way that I did it is the way to do it. No.
No.
It's like, you can't waste time talking about the what and how. You've got to really spend your time in the why. Because when you know the why, back to the quote that we were talking about, he who has a why to live for can bear with almost any how.
Yes.
And the Simon Sinek alternate is, he who has a why can create any what and how.
Mm-hmm. All the other decisions fall out of that once you know your why.
Yeah. Yeah, it almost feels like a bullseye, right? Like, that's it. Like, that's the thing to focus on.
It is, but it's so easy to not, because it's so easy to do. What's next? We live in an overloaded world, a crowded world, and there's so many inputs saying, do this, do this, do this, do this. And you just follow the path. Like, oh, I guess I should do that. I should do that. I should do that. And we never question the why, because, well, it must be a good reason. Somebody told me to do this. My manager told me to do this.
Right.
My parents told me to do this.
Right.
My peers told me to do this. I guess I'll just do it. We never ask that question, why? And, you know, I'll go a little more detail in my personal story. It's like, for me, when I was chasing this promotion at Google, like, I burned myself out badly. I was working those 100-hour weeks. I completely physically and mentally exhausted myself. I ended up like sick in bed for a week. And for the first time in my life at that point, I asked this question, why? Why do I want this promotion? What's so important? And I didn't have a good answer. I was just, because it's there. Like, because I always take on the challenge. I always exceed the expectations. And instead I said, wait, what if I didn't? And I came back from being sick and I was like, I'm not going to work this hard anymore. My manager was like, what do you mean? Like, I'm not doing that anymore. And she was like completely confused. She had like no idea what to do with this. Like, well, if you can't handle the work, I'm going to find somebody that can. I'm like, okay. If you can't handle the work, you're not getting that promotion. In fact, I'm going to have to slash your performance rating. I'm like, yep, I understand that. And that's what happened. And this set of consequences that would have been unimaginable failure to myself even like 3 weeks before became just the consequences. Like, my why had changed. It had changed from, I have to do whatever my manager says. I have to get that promotion. And it had changed to, I want to live my life, and I'm willing to accept the consequences of doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And boom, everything shifted. And, you know, it was really powerful for me to make that, to realize, oh, I had a choice. I could accept different consequences. And that kind of set me up for a whole different arc to my career, a whole different arc to my personal development, a whole different arc to my life after that decision in 2012.
Wow. I got to say, when you were saying, you know, why am I doing this or whatever, the answer almost felt like it's because that's what people expected of you.
Mm-hmm.
And it sparked in me this moment in my career when I, you know, same, right? Like, I know that feeling. I've been there, lived it. And again, the question bothered me of like, I know that this is what people expect of me. And so I love that you had a, well, I'm just going to flip it and this is the shift. I more so took like a micro step in that direction. And my micro step was to make more mistakes on purpose.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And to not do something that is 100% perfect done. And mm-hmm. what happens if it's like 60%, 40% to a really important group of individuals? And yeah. that was my little micro step decision of, you know, just testing the waters of, will I break? If I sort of like, you know, if I step over this belief of this is what's expected of me.
Yeah, that's so powerful. I mean, because there's a whole different side arc we go to about perfectionism, but it's like you were changing the meaning you make. The meaning you had made was like, I have to be perfect.
Yeah.
I can't make mistakes. And it worked for you. It got you to a certain place in your career. It brought you great success. It was very helpful to you. And you're like, what is it holding me back from? What if I could advance faster by doing only 60% instead of 100%? What if I stopped worrying about what people expect of me and choose my own expectations, make my own meaning?
Yeah.
And like, it's rare that people can let go of those expectations, because we're wired as social animals. We want to keep people around us happy, because back in the savannah, if we didn't keep the tribe happy, we would get, you know, left out to be killed and eaten by the lions or whatever. So there's a very, very strong impulse towards conformity in our wiring, but we can overcome it.
And I want to say, like not only wiring, but also in the way that we grow up, right? Like, we spend mm-hmm. 2 decades of our lives going through the schooling system, understanding that, I mean, 90% is what excellent is defined as. Like, 100% mm-hmm. means you win. 0% means, you know, you kind of failed, buddy, or like 50% means, so like, these numbers teach you about what good and bad looks and feels like. And so mm-hmm. not only is it, you know, the evolutionary thing, but it's also the conditioning over yes. decades of your life. And so yes. it's not surprising that there comes a time in people's career, in, you know, a stage, like a moment, a change, or something dramatic has happened, and you fall into this line of, wait, what am I doing? What's this for? Why?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, and well, again, not to get too radical here, but like, we are conditioned that way for a reason, because the people who are in power want us to be conditioned to not think we have a choice and to fall into line and to show up to the factory and work 9 to 5 without questioning what we've been told to do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a whole political angle to this that I'm not going to get into right now.
Of
but
course. Yeah, yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It is, we are conditioned for a reason, and it takes some interruption for us to question that conditioning and to ask these questions of why, what are we doing?
Yeah.
And my interruption was this form was me burning out. Sounds like you had a similar experience, and it's like,
it's familiar. I think the story that you have is a familiar one. The one that I think, even if we haven't acted on in the same way, you know what mm-hmm. it feels like and you know the signs for it.
Yeah.
Before we hit record, Eric, you and I were kind of, you know, chit-chatting about this book and the quotes from the book. And we were both mm-hmm. like, there are quotes, man, in this book that are just so memorable. We've talked about a few. Is there any others that you want to bring up, you know, that have really impacted you?
So this one didn't impact me, but I was rereading this in anticipation of our conversation, and there was a quote I'm going to I bookmarked here because I just loved it so much because it's getting to what we talked about here.
Yeah.
It's everything can be taken from a man, but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And there are always choices to make. Every day, every hour, offered the opportunity to make a decision which determined whether you would or would not submit to those powers which threatened to rob you of your very self, your inner freedom, which determined whether or not you would become the plaything of circumstance, renouncing freedom and dignity to become molded into the form of the typical inmate. And it was just like, wow, every day, every hour, we have a choice to choose how we want to show up. Do we want to be the typical inmate, or in our case, the typical worker? Or do we choose to be ourselves? Do we embrace that freedom of how we make meaning of our lives?
Wow. Wow. And, you know, I have to call out the tension in that too, right? Because he also speaks of this tension. Like when you think about the meaning of your life, there's this tension between, there's this tension between, I can't find it, but I'm going to find it. Yeah. The inner tension. So he says, okay, man's search for meaning may arouse inner tension over inner equilibrium. And, you know, I love that he talks about the science behind, you know, in biology, there's this word called homeostasis, which is a tensionless state. And he talks about how mental health is based on a certain degree of tension. And the tension between what has already been achieved and what one still ought to accomplish, or the gap between what one is and what one should become. And so he says that we should not be hesitant about challenging people with a potential meaning for them to fulfill, because it's this tension that's essential.
Yeah. I think that's so spot on. We're not built for comfort in some sense. And he has another quote. What man actually needs is the striving and struggling for a worthwhile goal, a freely chosen task.
Yes.
And it's like,
yes.
But you know what you're talking about with the tension reminds me of another quote, for another idea from.
There's so many. Parker. There's so many. Yeah.
Well, this one isn't from Frankl. It's from an activist named Parker Palmer, who calls it the tragic gap. There's the world as it is today, and there's the world as it could be. And if you fall too closely into adhering to the world as it is today, you're like, this is just the way it is. You fall into what he calls corrosive cynicism. You're like, okay, I'm just going to accept it and do the best for myself, look out for myself. And if you fall too much in like, this is the way things could be, you fall into what Parker Palmer calls irrelevant idealism.
Right.
Like you're no connected to the real world. You're just like living in a fantasy. And what he calls the tragic gap is like standing with one foot in both worlds. And it's painful because you're never going to get to the ideals. And you're always anchored to the horrors and the suffering of the world as it is today. But he's like, in the tragic gap, that's where all the change happens. That's where all the meaningful work happens, by bridging those two worlds. And you have to accept that you will never be done with the work. And you show up every day and do it anyway, because it's important. You know, like this idea that like, yes, it sucks. It's hard. Change making is hard. And the way he calls it the tragic gap, I was like, oof, that hits me so hard.
It's visceral for sure. Oh man, that's gorgeous. So I got to say, you know, we're talking about meaning. We're talking about creating meaning in our lives. We're talking about how he, you know, how he figured out what was essential and necessary. I wanted to share with you at the end of this book, this is not, you know, part of the story. It's the afterword, he was once asked to express the meaning of his own life. Did you read this part? Did you get to this part?
I don't remember that. You'll have to refresh
it. I'd love to share with you. Yeah. So he, as you know, became a lecturer, and he loves to share, teach, dream with people, and co-create with others. And so he was asked to express in one sentence the meaning of his own life by his students. And he thought about it, and he wrote a response on paper, and he asked his students to guess what he would have written down. And so after a moment of quiet reflection, one student got it spot on, and he said, "The meaning of your life is to help others find the meaning of theirs." How
Love
spot
it.
On. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. He said, that was it. That's exactly the words that I had written down as well.
Mm-hmm.
What a gorgeous gift. I want it. Like, this truly feels like a gift. How painful it must have been. If the story wants to come out of you and you wrote it in 9 days, but it feels so personal that you want to keep it anonymous, but you choose to not anyway, and you choose to share because there is a learning in the sharing. What a gorgeous gift.
Yeah. And I mean, so for those that haven't read it, the book is like, there's two parts. Part one is just this, the account of his time in the concentration camp. And part two is kind of like his making meaning of it several years later of like, okay, this is what I'm going to do with what I learned.
Yeah.
And he shares some of, he calls it logotherapy, like therapy through finding meaning.
Yeah.
And I just remember this, like one of the stories he starts that part two off with is like somebody comes into his office and says like, "I hate my job. And I've been working with this therapist who thinks like my problem with my job is like my issues with my father." And like they're going back and forth on that.
Right.
And Venkata looks up and is like, "Well, what do you care about?" He's like, "Well, I care about this over here." It's like, yeah, your job doesn't give you that. Go do the thing that gives you meaning. Like, you don't have a mental disorder. You're just in the wrong job. Like, that, it's not that hard.
Yeah.
But it was just like, it's so interesting how we can pathologize or I'm not sure what the right word is, but like turn these things into like, oh, this is like a fundamental problem with who I am, versus like, no, this is not the meaning that makes sense to me at this specific point in time. Back to your earlier point.
Yeah.
This point in time, this is not providing me the meaning I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Let me change that. Let me go find that. And so his kind of very practical approach in that sense, I really appreciate it. It's like, it's not about trying to find what's wrong. It's like, let's find your meaning and find ways to connect to it.
Yeah. I was going to close by asking you that same question about, for anyone who has not read it, what do you believe are the lessons from this book that can help people today in 2024 navigate modern day challenges and uncertainties? Because this book was actually born out of what happened in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that, you know, make sense to the modern individual today?
Well, we've touched on a bunch of it. I mean, the Simon Sinek, Start With Why, the Parker Palmer quote I shared, the tragic gap of like what it means to be an activist. But I think it really comes back to this getting clear for yourself on what matters to you.
Yeah.
And not letting the expectations of others dominate your own internal narrative, your own internal meaning making. And I mean, part of this is also we have a culture that says, like, you can have it all. You can do this and this. You can be, like, a great parent and a great partner and amazing at work and run triathlons in your free time and publish a book. And it's like, do it all. And it's like, yeah, but what if I don't want all that? Like, or I do want all of that, but realize I don't have the capacity to do all that. Like, and then getting very clear for myself, like, what is most important to me?
Yeah.
And so I work as an executive coach. I work with leaders. And like, that's always the first question. Like, what does success mean to you?
Yeah.
What's important to you? And they're like, I don't know. I just like, I'm like, how, getting promoted? I'm like, no, nope, that's not it. let's just dig a little deeper. What would that mean? And it's so, people just never stop to ask the question.
Yeah. You know, what this reminds me of is this concept of awaken the wanter within. Like, awaken that inner person, that inner thing within that knows how to want.
Because
when you get clear on the wanting, the how doesn't matter anymore.
Well, yeah. Once you're clear on the wanting, you can figure out what to do about it.
Yeah.
But I love that quote. Reminds me of a friend of mine once offered me some advice or a perspective I hadn't thought of. They're like, my friend was like, "Yeah, I love feeling jealous." I'm like, "Really? Why would you love feeling jealous?" She's like, "Well, when I'm jealous, it makes it very clear what I want.
Yo, that's good. That's deep.
Right?
Yes.
Like, because you're not jealous of somebody that doesn't have something you want. Like, I'm not jealous of the car. Like, I don't care about the car. But that person, I'm jealous of them. Oh, why? Ooh, what do they have that I don't want? How could I go after that? And then with that clarity, you know what you want and you can make a plan for it.
Love that. And you choose your attitude as well.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Oof.
Yeah.
That's like a snaps moment. Like, ooh. Okay. So this book, Eric, was the one that you were like, this is the one, Char, this is the one that really built me. For anybody who is curious about your journey and, you know, what else you read and typically the books that you enjoy, is there another book that you truly feel has changed you or built you?
If you're watching on video, you can see I have a lot of books. There are a lot of books. It's hard to pick one. I mean, one I often come back to, even though I don't reread it, I probably should one of these days. It's Finite and Infinite Games by James Carse. Mm. It's a very simple book. It's very short. It's actually similar size to this, like a little paperback. You can stick it in your pocket. But the central concept is this idea of finite games, which are games with an ending, with rules, and where the objective is to win. Whatever the game is. And so much of our life is built around winning games like this. Like, I want to get the best grade. I want to be the top on the curve. I want to make the most money. I want to get the promotion. There's a limited number of winners, and I want to be one of them. And these are the rules I'm going to follow to play the game. And Carse contrasts that with infinite games, where that's not the point at all. The point is to keep playing. You change the rules. You change the circumstances so you can keep going after what really matters, which is the play, the interaction, the relationship. And that's bigger things like spirituality, science, community. Like, we can change the rules of community to support the community growth. And recognizing when I'm trapping myself in a finite game, I have to do this, I have to do that. These are the rules. Mm. And saying, no, I can change the rules and do something different. So, like, I have to earn the promotion. I have to do whatever my manager says. That's a finite game. And I change the rule. I have to do whatever my manager says, unless I'm willing to accept the consequences. Oh, now I'm out of that game. I'm playing a new game, which is the game of my own personal development. So even though I can't remember the book that well, I read it like 20-something years ago, but that concept is one that comes up constantly. What are the rules I'm holding myself to that's a finite game, and I can change them to play a bigger, more infinite game?
Gorgeous. Gorgeous. Thank you for sharing all of this wisdom with us, Eric, today. This was such a wonderful conversation. Thank you for being here, being present with us, and just opening up. It's been so wonderful to be in conversation with you.
Thanks, Char. I really enjoyed this conversation, and thank you for having me dive deep on a book that I really enjoy. Mm. I really find meaning in, I should say.
That's it for this episode of Books That Built Me. If you've enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave us a review. It really helps support what we're doing. Even a sentence is sufficient. Thanks for listening, and you can always find me on my LinkedIn at Char Banerjee. If you're dealing with a leadership challenge, then I would love to hear from you and have you join our awesome community. And of course, I will talk to you next Tuesday on a brand new episode of Books That Built Me.